Dr. Tammy B. Hill is going to be our speaker this month for the Communication Research Colloquium Series. We're very excited to have Dr. B. Hill start us off this fall. Dr. B. Hill is an assistant professor in the Department of Mass Communication, Advertising, and Public Relations here at Boston University. Her research interests include political rhetoric. She does a lot of work when it comes down to different area topics in not only in the area of campaigns, but also women as political communicators and the analysis of popular culture as well. Her most recent book, Connecting with Constituents, Identification Building and Locking in Contemporary National Convention Speeches, explores speeches, great title actually, delivered at national nominating conventions from historic, strategic, and analytic perspectives, and illustrates the importance of nominating conventions as part of an ongoing national conversation about the political character of a country. So I'm delighted to also not only present Dr. B. Hill, but please join me in welcoming her as the first speaker this fall in our series.
I put all the key dates up here because I felt compelled to include numbers of some sort. So for all of you number junkies, there you go, we're all done. So, except the occasional 2016 that shows up, or 2012. So what we're going to do when I was asked if I'd like to do this, it was spring of last year. We were in the middle of the primary debate season, and it's sure our primary voting contest. And what happened, I've got debates on the brain, you know, they're coming up pretty quickly too. And so it seemed like there might be actually a contested convention for the first time since 1976. So that's why it became the idea of the coronation becomes a battlefield again. But if you guys watched what ended up happening, we kind of said maybe not, or at least not so much. There's a little bit of battling that went on, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in a little while. But the made a little slight modification because it wasn't quite the battlefield that some of us who study this kind of stuff had hoped for. So let's talk a little bit to begin with about conventions broadly, and then we're going to talk specifically about some examples and things that we learned from the current 2016 conventions on both sides of the aisle. First thing, whenever I talk about conventions, the first thing most people ask me is, do they actually matter? Do conventions really matter? And there are a lot of people, I will be perfectly honest, that say no, that they don't really matter anymore, that they are basically throwbacks to a bygone era, a time when we actually did engage in these grand deliberative debates. So we need to start from the beginning and say, why do they matter and why might they? So those who say no basically say that the predictability of campaigns these days tend to make most of the general election campaign, they don't usually say useless, but not terribly relevant to the outcome of the election. So if all you really care about is the actual final tally, the final vote, then sometimes you can actually, through some really sophisticated polling and statistical analysis, there have been times when they've been predicting the outcomes of the elections in June and July. Nate Silver did this in 2008 and 2012. He's a little hesitant to put out any predictions this year. I kind of don't blame him. Abramowitz did the same kind of thing. And so there are some people who say, since we can predict what's going to happen already, the campaigns are just a big waste of money. So those are some of the people who say, no, conventions don't matter. There are also the people who say the ephemeral nature of the convention bump, the fact that convention bumps exist but then don't last, mean that these don't really have much impact, and they're kind of a waste of time and money as well. So those folks say, no, this doesn't really matter. And then there are the people who do go with the outdated ritual from a bygone era. These are usually the folks who sort of wax nostalgic for those grand days of the smoke-filled room and the fisticuffs on the convention floor when people would battle and fight. And they'd say that, it was great when they used to be real deliberative events, and now they're no longer so deliberative. But it's kind of an interesting thing, because if you're a student of the actual words and the rhetoric that occurred, you see that maybe they actually weren't as exciting as they were made out to be. There were clear decisions that were being made during those throwback kinds of times. There were times when it would take 104 ballots to figure out who was going to be the presidential nominee for the party. So you can't say that there was no deliberation going on. But Michael Pfau did a big archival study in which he discovered that as early as 1835, which was the year before the 1836 election, but the second convention for the Democratic Party, there were already great pressures from party members and party leaders to actually mute dissent and to get people to not argue. And the whole point of getting them to not argue was so that they provided a unified front, so that people, there was no external kinds of uses for what was going on that was going to be negative, so they could really control the message. So they were trying to control the message early out of the gate, because the newspapers would report on fights, and back then the newspapers were very biased, they were very partisan, and so you would get these stories that would run over and over again. The competition would take those elements of fight and they would use them in their campaign literature moving through the rest of the campaign. So it became really, really important, they thought, to try to actually mute the dissent that was going on, which meant that maybe those early conventions weren't quite as deliberative and exciting as they seemed to be. Usually they were issue-oriented, platform-oriented, but less so in terms of the actual candidates themselves, or at least that's Michael Fowle's argument. So the deliberative versus epideictic argument is kind of interesting too, to me, because deliberative usually means decision-making, epideictic usually means ceremonial, right? And so when you just split them out that way, it usually makes it sound like epideictic is important because we make decisions based on it, and ceremonial is just for fun, right? But in truth, even Aristotle would say that those blended a little bit more together than we actually would want to think that they did. Everybody wants these clear delineations, and those aren't actually accurate. Epideictic or ceremonial rhetoric is often very influential in people's decision-making when they're trying to choose whether or not they like somebody, choose a candidate even. I mean, think about now, we're talking about all these likability ratings and the low likability ratings that are going on in the presidential campaign. Epideictic rhetoric actually influences those kinds of perceptions. So it's not as easy as just saying it's either or that one is better or worse than the other. So it's a little bit problematic when we make that distinction. But we still make that distinction. Even I did it. I still called it a coronation, right? I said when the coronation became a battlefield again. We see the idea of this frame of coronation occur over and over and over again when we're talking about conventions, and it's usually used in extremely derisive and dismissive kind of manner, right? You don't say, yay, let's watch the coronation. I mean, granted, if you were British, maybe you would, right? Although we wouldn't know that, it's been so long, okay? But the idea is that we still have this idea, the Democratic Convention goes from coronation to chaos. Granted, there's the alliteration idea, you like that. But you still have all of these sort of, none of these are excited about the idea of coronation. Right? They don't make it sound as though it's actually useful. And that's one of the problems with this dismissive coronation frame, is that it actually implies that there's nothing to learn from these events. It encourages people to not care, not want to pay attention. When you're dismissive of this ritual, for the mere fact that it seems to be just a ritual, then it sort of encourages people to unplug. And what it does is it prevents us from really looking closely at all the things that we actually really do learn, or can, if we're willing to dig deeply, that we can really learn from conventions and convention content. So today we're going to talk about what do we actually learn, because when we talk about this, it kind of sets this really negative tone, like, yeah, nobody cares about conventions. Well, I do. I care about conventions. I care deeply about conventions, and this is just a little shameless self-promotion. This is just a small sampling of the work that I do on conventions or convention-related work. Right now I'm working on a current book project that looks at the representation of spouses, candidates' spouses, and one of the major components is how they reflect themselves to the public, especially through their convention participation and their convention speeches. What are they saying about themselves, and what does that say then about gender representations and gender expectations? It's a really exciting project. I'm like, oh, I'd love to talk about that the whole time, but we don't really have time for that. So I've done a lot of things with these spouses, with particular kinds of speeches like acceptance addresses. The book itself has a couple basic introductory kinds of chapters, but then every other chapter looks at a type of speech. So surrogate speeches,
presidential acceptance addresses, vice presidential acceptance addresses, spouses' speeches, keynote addresses, gives history, and then analysis from 1980 to 2012, and then very deep analysis of 2012. Came out last October, so forgive me, it does not include 2016. That's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. So I really care deeply about conventions. I think they're really, really important, and I think there's a whole lot that we can learn about them. I say, you know, when people ask, do conventions really matter? I say conventions really do matter. Really do. Maybe I should highlight the really instead of do. They do matter. They reveal perspectives on potential leaders, of potential leaders, like how do they see us? What do they think? What is their attitude? Very much revealed in all of the different messaging that occurs in a convention. The conventions demonstrate the organizational abilities of the people who would be leaders. So when something is very poorly organized or something goes crazy and chaotic, tells us something about their actual organizational skills. They allow the parties to celebrate, to confirm, or sometimes to challenge the accepted philosophies of their actual organization, right? And their traditions, that gets them to reflect those. And they reflect social and political change. So I think they do a whole lot of things, and that's why I write that they do a whole lot of things, and I try to prove that out in the research that I do. But I'm not the only one. Others also say things about campaigns, particularly conventions, being reflections of who we are as a people, where we have been, and where we are going. If you look really carefully and closely, they're very, very informative pieces for us, pieces of information. Why? Because, as I've written here, they're carefully constructed. Right? They're very carefully constructed. People put a lot of time, effort, and energy, with the exception of maybe Clint Eastwood's speech in 2012, into making sure that their message is clear, concise, that it fits into the overall stream of things. And so it really becomes an important thing to look at, because it's the face that they want to present. So we want to dissect it and understand it so that we know who they are, even the things that they say that they don't mean to say. We can still uncover some of the underlying ideas and arguments. So we're going to focus today on 2016, the RNC and the DNC. I'm going to use 2016, those two conventions, and then a little bit from 2012, just because I can't resist the Clint Eastwood example that I just mentioned, and we'll mention again momentarily, to demonstrate the larger social and political lessons that we learned from conventions, and also to underscore the value of closely examining the kinds of speeches that occur, especially the ones that recur often, because they tell us about the changes that are going on. So we're going to pay a little bit of concentrated effort here on keynotes, on spouses' speeches, and on presidential acceptances. Okay, so that's kind of the map of where we're going for the rest of this talk. So let's talk about social information to begin with. One of the biggest things that I think is extremely revealing and reveals the importance or highlights the importance of focusing on the broader history. If you came in early, you saw I had the key dates in history up there. If you go back and you take the contextual look, the long view, you actually get a lot more information about social changes that have occurred. So if we take a look, and then we're going to also talk about communication technologies and what they tell us, the influences of communication technologies. So changes in participation, participants, the history. There are three broad areas that I think are really key to understanding changes and the social changes in the world that have happened and how they're reflected in conventions. The first is the actual inclusion of candidates for the nomination in conventions. Originally, when conventions started, there was this grand philosophy where they argued that the office sought the man. And yes, it was sexist. The office sought the man. Which meant you weren't supposed to be power hungry, you weren't supposed to show that you wanted power, you were supposed to sort of have them want you instead of you wanting, have the office seek you instead of you seeking the office. So candidates didn't really participate very much in the actual conventions themselves, or if they were at a convention and it became clear that they were going to become the nominee, they would step out, they would leave, they would go away, and they'd let the vote happen. That way it didn't look like they were seeking it. They weren't active. They would send surrogates. They'd have surrogates speak on their behalves. Until about 1876, Samuel Tilden was the first at the DNC that year to actually campaign for himself, to say, I want this spot, you should want me, and it actually worked. So then after that, a lot of people started doing it. It became the norm. Now it became so much the norm that our candidates, you can't even get them off the stage sometimes. So they're so active and so participatory. So that was one big shift that occurred, was the beginning of the candidates participating. Then that took another step forward in 1932 when FDR was the first person to actually accept the nomination at the convention. What a lot of people don't often realize, and getting back to the sort of ceremonial nature of contemporary conventions, was that people used to, they used to have two separate events. One was the convention, where the decision-making was supposed to be made, and then the second, a few weeks later, they would have these notification ceremonies. And it started out that it was just a few committee members who would show up at somebody's house, and they would say, hey, we're nominating you. And they already knew, because it had been in the newspapers, they'd been told, they knew what was going on, but they would pretend to be surprised, and they would say, okay, I'll get back to you with an answer in written form in a little while. It didn't take terribly long before reporters started following along. Right? There'd be a couple of committee members, a reporter, and then the party members started saying, wow, you know, we could turn this into something. So they became these huge rituals. They were sort of circus-like events where they'd have speeches, they'd have bands, they'd have parades, and that would be the notification ritual. Right? So in 1932, when Roosevelt decided that he, in the midst of the Depression, did not want the expense or the show of a big party at that time, he said, keep the delegates on the floor, I will come, I will do my speech there. And then since then, the Democrats have done that all the time. The Republicans started doing it with Dewey in 1940, and then they've been doing it since then. So that's when it really started to merge this idea of the epideictic and the deliberative together. It was 1980, really, when the sort of rest of the deliberative sort of fell out, and it's all become more of the celebratory nature kinds of things. That's why I put up those key dates for you guys before. Okay. So that is one big shift. It changed our attitude toward the candidates. It changed our understanding of who should be participating and whether or not it was okay to seek power. And at that point, by the mid 20th century, it was more than okay. It was encouraged, and people should be actually doing it. So that's one part. Then we've got the idea of the inclusion of people of color. That tells us a lot about our society and our social interactions. You'll see that there was an early, like the late 1800s, late 19th century, you've got a lot of participation. There was actually quite a bit of participation by African Americans, particularly in the RNC. And then at the turn of the century, as the Ku Klux Klan started to gain in power, a lot of participation on both sides really fell off. So people of color were not represented. So you see a sort of reflection of what was going on in society happening and who was participating in the actual conventions themselves. And then you see again, middle of the century and then moving to the second half of the 20th century, another uptick in people of color participating. And there's a whole lot more that we could have also included. These are just some of the firsts, right, near the on this end of the century. And then in the 2000s, you've got, you know, of course, Barack Obama as the first African-American nominee. So some key moments, but you see the shifts in society, who gets to participate, where they get to participate. You also get a little bit of the shift in where parties stand. It was that the Republicans were the party of diversity, and then it became the Democrats who were the party of diversity, right, and inclusion. So you get a little of that. And then women, the same kind of thing. You get a reflection of the progression of women in politics and their ability and how they were welcomed or not welcomed at political events. 1912, I love the little story about Helen Taft, because 1912 is kind of an interesting hallmark moment. She is, as far as anybody has recorded, the only wife of a candidate to attend the opposite party's convention. Mm-hmm. So she was the wife of the Republican nominee. She went to his convention, all fine and good. But then she shows up at the Democratic convention, and she sits in the very front row. Mm-hmm. And all the archival research shows, and there are some letters and things to show it as well, that she did that specifically to get the speakers at the Democratic convention to not rail against her husband quite so fervently. So I love the story because it's a couple of things. One, how gutsy of her. I mean, we haven't seen that happen again. You don't see Michelle Obama, you didn't see her in 2012 sitting in the front of the RNC, right? You didn't see Bill Clinton, although that would be a whole different issue, sitting in front of the RNC this year. But what ended up happening was it tells us something about how women were viewed. It would have been disrespectful to have spoken ill of her husband with her sitting there. Right? And so on the one hand, it was great because she could actually attend. There was a time when they were too raucous and rowdy for women, that women would sully their purity, their moral purity, by attending. Now they're attending and they're actually influencing in very key ways. So the 20th century was really big for women in conventions, moving all the way through, and including things like the Republicans saying you have to have one male, one female representative as early as 1924 so that there's an equality of representation going on. That happened right after, of course, the right to vote. They get the right to vote. So then people say, hey, maybe that'll actually influence. Let's get them in here. So it tells us something about our history.
And of course, Lena Springs, which gets to be the first woman vice president, you know, put in for a nomination for the vice presidency. So just little tidbits. So what is the 2016? What did the RNC and DNC tell us about participants? What is the reflection that we get from this? Well, first of all, we've got the idea of Donald Trump participating every single night. He either spoke or showed up in influence speeches, right? If you guys didn't see the part where he showed up at the end of Ted Cruz's speech, right? And Ted Cruz basically got booed off the stage for not endorsing him. So he was influencing speeches, or he was giving speeches pretty much every night, either by video or on stage. He's the first nominee to introduce his spouse. Spouses have introduced nominees before, but he's the first nominee to introduce his spouse. And you got the lovely, you know, when he actually came out in the cloud of whatever. So what does that say? It's really, and then Hillary Clinton actually was part of three of the four nights. There was only one night she didn't actually show up herself, either video screen or in person. So it really talks about tells us more about the continued turn toward personality and person-driven politics. People are really, it becomes the candidate as important, more so sometimes than the ideologies, than the issues, because they're dominating the coverage and they're dominating the campaign planning. Okay. You've also got the first woman presidential nominee, and when you look at the actual breakdown of speakers, the amount of time they were given, and when they actually spoke, the Democrats showcased more diverse speakers in primetime speaking slots, although it was slightly less diverse than previous years. It was still significantly more diverse in the major roles and in the amount of time given to people of color and to women than the Republican Party. Right? So that talks about, it's indicative of the party's concerns of diversity and inclusion. And also when you start looking closely at some of the speeches and some of the content of the speeches, there are some reflections of vast differences in the depictions of what is a true citizen and what is a true patriot in terms of their demographics. And then the RNC's missing figures, the fact that for the first time in a very long time at a convention, there was no past president, even though there are two living past presidents. There were the most recent nominees who were still alive didn't show up, and many of the key figures of the party didn't show up for the RNC, really spoke to the divisions in the party and the problems that are going on in the internal party fights. So you get a lot of interesting elements just from looking at who showed up and who participated and how they participated. When we talk about the influences of technology, there are a couple of key things that I just want to focus on. There's tons, and there are lots of people in this room who are far more expert than I am, so I just want to give little highlights as to what we can learn generally from them by looking at the rhetorical elements. There are more videos that are being used through the events now than they used to be, partially because it's easier to make videos, partially because the streaming of the videos is easier to convey them to a home audience, all of those kinds of things. Technology improves, makes it easier to use those kinds of things. Also, the fact that the nominees are picked earlier, right, they're picked through the primary process, means that those kinds of elements can be created more effectively earlier on, right? If you were trying to decide on your nominee on the spot at the convention, would you have the big bio of your candidate done? Would you have the sort of, here's how they helped in this particular case? Or do you see what I'm saying? You wouldn't even be able to actually create video components of the opposition because you wouldn't know who your actual opponent was going to be. So the epideictic nature, the ceremonial nature of the now conventions actually allows for better planning of convention content, including the videos, and then that tells us stuff about what the party's thinking and what they think will be appealing to us as voting public. Okay. Videos used to be just tributes, then they became these bios, these sort of brief biographies of people's lives, the most famous one probably being the Man from Hope, right? Man from Hope, 1992 Bill Clinton story. Now they are transition points,
They're used to introduce any number of people. They're used to introduce new issues and topics. They can be used in all kinds of different ways. They get the DNC this year, 2016. They were used almost like commercial breaks. And then those turned into a lot of then campaign ads for the general election. Another couple of influences, and these are really kind of intertwined, is that there's still the encouragement from way back when, because there's additional means for dissemination and because social media allows for more manipulation of views, of images, of content, and more people to engage in the manipulation of content, it becomes more important than ever for folks to try to create this unified front, because you have no control really of where it goes from there. Okay? And so you want to try to make it as positive as you possibly can, and as controlled as you can, understanding that you're never going to control the images. We've got some examples. First of all, the video thing. Mm-hmm. The video thing doesn't always work, by the way. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes it's really compelling, but if you watched the DNC, they had the video of the fight song. Did you guys see the video fight song? How many of you guys saw this? Just curious. All right. Well, it was basically a remake. They had a bunch of celebrities remaking a popular song. It was the song for Hillary. It was like the DNC anthem, the song for Hillary. And it was kind of, if you guys saw the Barack Obama Yes We Can video from 2008, where they took his speech, his concession speech from New Hampshire, turned it into a video, a music video that actually won an Emmy. And they used a lot of celebrities sort of singing parts of his speech. They were trying to do the similar thing here with Clinton, except what ended up happening is it came across as too forced. It came across as they were trying too hard. It was not an original song, as opposed to the Obama, which was in his original speech. So it became really trashed, and there was a big negative response. In fact, I saw a bunch of Twitter feeds where people were saying, you know, if I need to watch this video again, I'm going to poke my eye out instead, and stuff like that. So it really got a negative response. So it doesn't mean that just because they have these elements that it's going to be positive. And sometimes they might be well-meaning and try to follow off of successful previous components. Doesn't always mean that it's going to work, though, because you got to know who your audience is. And I showed this video actually to my 380 class, and they didn't know who half the people in the video were. So that also didn't work out very well for them, although I didn't know who the other half was. So we shared with each other, and it worked out okay. All right, and then the other side to this, and looking at 2016, there really wasn't quite the united front that everybody would probably want. The DNC email leak was a pretty good example of that. You have Debbie Wasserman Schultz getting booted the morning of, basically, and people were saying, oh, is she still going to gavel it in? And of course she couldn't after her meeting with Florida delegates. Bernie supporters booing on the convention floor. I mean, basically every time Hillary's name was said, there was a boo that went up, right? And even more so than that, the reporting of the booing. I spoke to several people who were actually at the convention who said it didn't sound nearly as bad as the reporting indicated that it was. So if you're watching at home, it seemed like it was even worse. The Republicans fared no better. Their rules battle that happened right out of the gate the first afternoon that resulted in the Colorado delegates walking out, and there were pictures all over the internet of that big empty space where the Colorado folks were supposed to be, and the replay of the rules battle where they were saying, hey, we want to be listened to, we want to have our dissent. It was a little bit tricky for them. And then of course the Ted Cruz speech that we talked a little bit about before, where he got booed for not endorsing Trump. So there were clear problems with the united front idea. But what we do is when we look a little bit closer at how things got handled, it reveals differences again in the party. The treatment of the dissenters were wildly different. First of all, what happened at the RNC, the dissenters were basically quieted. The rules folks, just if you guys saw that footage, what happened was they said, any no's, there were a bunch of no's, and they said, okay, I'm calling it for the yays, and kept moving on. And so that became a big issue. They were just completely ignored. On the DNC front, the Bernie Sanders folks, from the reports that have come out, they were actually allowed to boo. Some people started to hush them, and the ushers said, no, let them be, because the party planners had said, let them have a little bit of time so they can kind of let off the steam, and then we move on. And so by the second and third night, we'll have a little bit more. And then by the time Michelle Obama showed up, nobody was booing Michelle Obama. You saw that speech, it was phenomenal. It's one of the most perfect, not perfect, there's no such thing as a perfect speech, but it was a pretty damn good convention speech.
for the record. That's an official rhetorical analysis there. Okay. So the treatment varied differently. The ways that they handled the people who were dissenting actually tells a lot about the openness of the party versus the closedness and what the sort of culture of the organization is at that time. So you had a little bit more closed perspectives on the Republican side, a little bit more open perspectives with the hope that it was going to work, and it seemed to actually end up working, that it was more accepting of the change. Now, granted, the Bernie folks just went outside and started protesting even more, but you know, that got them off the convention floor. They got their say for the moment. And then the idea that reporting highlights the long-held concerns of the planners. If you didn't see it, the Shorenstein Center actually came out with a report this morning that showed the negative ratings of the convention coverage that occurred on both sides. And they said, their report shows that 82% of stories that came out during conventions were negative on both sides, for Clinton and for Trump. So it was extremely negative. So when the party planners are saying, let's try to be as united as possible, let's try to mute dissent, let's make this as celebratory as possible because we don't want to have the negative backlash, there are two things. One, their fears are not unfounded, but two, doesn't seem to matter, right? Because you're still getting the reports that you're going to be getting. So the parties are actually penalized for deliberative exchanges. And so you can't really have deliberative exchanges without dissent, and then they get big stories about the dissent, becomes kind of an issue. So there's sort of really problematic issues that are going on in terms of what they can even do to make that happen. So 16, not so united, but moving in that direction in different kinds of ways. Also, when we start talking about the uncontrollable nature of the responses to content, right? We're talking about social media. What happened in 2012 was, I think, one of the best examples you can find of this. And that is, if you didn't see it, Clint Eastwood came out on the final night of the RNC and debated an empty chair. Brought out an empty chair, said, look, President Obama is sitting in this chair. Let's debate him. And then I don't think there has been anybody who would argue that it was coherent. Right? Nobody would say, yes, that was very coherent. It was very incoherent. So it was kind of rambling, didn't make much sense. It was really, really difficult to follow. And what ended up happening was, so he spoke, he gave this weird, very, it was like a surreal moment where you're saying, like, what? And then you get Marco Rubio, who actually gave a superb speech that nobody remembers. And then you get Mitt Romney, who gives his nomination acceptance address, who people remember just because they kind of have to. But everybody for the next couple of weeks talking about Eastwood. And online, they actually started this hashtag Eastwooding, and people were posting pictures of themselves debating furniture. Right? Empty chairs, benches, and then, you know, people were doing things like The Simpsons, old man yells at chair. Right? So they were making fun of Clint Eastwood and also not paying attention to Mitt Romney, not paying attention to the message that the RNC wanted to have going out of the actual convention itself. I like this one too. That's just kind of a fun little pop culture reference going in. So uncontrollable responses to what's going on and how people are going to pay attention. So you can't really always control their attention. That's why you need to try to control the message. Had Clint Eastwood been held to the same standards as many of the usual speakers, where he had to actually, present a manuscript of his speech, where he had to practice and his speech was actually vetted, then maybe they wouldn't have had this much of a problem. So a lot of the control that goes into it might actually help to prevent these kinds of issues. But it doesn't always, because content isn't always controllable either. We see that this year with the 2016 balloons. Okay? If you saw the DNC that last night, boy, could they have put one more balloon in that space? I just don't know if they could have. And what ended up happening is it then provided this fodder for online fun. Right? On the one hand, it's kind of, you know, it seems like it should be innocuous. It's just people playing with balloons. And really, if a whole bunch of balloons fell down and this on us right now, would you just be very stoically watching them? He's like, yes, absolutely. I would not touch the balloon. Right? You'd probably have a little bit of fun with it. We'd have some laughter, that kind of stuff. So people were particularly impressed by how much fun Bill Clinton had with them. In fact, he went on The Daily Show last week, and they finished his segment by dropping balloons on him.
That's what you do now with Bill Clinton, apparently. I just want someone to love me like Bill Clinton loves balloons. You can't control what people are going to do with the content, so you're hopefully trying to control the content itself. Now this one on the other side, I don't know if you've seen it, it's actually an in motion kind of thing. And so on this side you've got Donald Trump in the speech where he was making fun of the New York Times reporter, the disabled reporter. And then that's Hillary Clinton responding to the initial drop of the balloons. And the argument is 319 million people and these are the two we narrowed it down to, right? So it's a big critique of our choices. But I do have to say, just personally, from a kind of rhetorical content standing kind of idea, you got somebody who's making fun of handicapped individuals versus someone in awe of balloons. I don't know if I take that critique. But the idea still is that you're making them look like buffoons, both of them looking silly. And so you can't control the content, and you got to make sure that you're understanding that. A little bit tricky. Okay. And then the uncontrollable critiques that happen. You also can't control who's getting involved in critiquing or how they're actually critiquing. And I think Melania's speech or Melania's Michelle speech, however you want to call it, became sort of grounds for that, where they took some contents and pictures and they kind of made, first of all, you have some sort of the irony, the hypocrisy element being called out. You've got just some plain fun with plagiarism. Yeah. You've got the idea that you incorporate also a critique of the Trump University scandal going on, so you can mix all kinds of things together. Or, you know, you can honor Michelle Obama as being the only woman to speak at both conventions this year. So you get to make fun, and people can make fun and enjoy and join in on the political dialogue. So these controllable elements and the inclusion of more people means that there's an increased visibility of citizen participation, because we see it every day. I open my Facebook and sometimes I don't want to see what's in there, but people are posting memes and responses and they're actually participating, so there's a higher increased visibility and potential for people to participate. And so that says something about our society right now. But along with that, there's so much that the impact of their individual critiques might be diminished. Because if you've got 100 memes out there, you're not likely to read all of them. Unless you're like me and I'm looking for them for classwork stuff. I'm like, oh, let's find a new meme. And I'm like, 500 memes later, I'm laughing and not having my courses prepped. But that's a whole different story. And then there's selectivity and seeming polarization that occurs here. People will look for the things that support their own perspective. They'll ignore the things that don't support their perspective. And then that tends to polarize them a little bit more, at least personality-wise, if not issue-wise as well. Although later on we'll talk a little bit more about the issues. But more definitely personality-wise, it sort of divides people up and makes a little bit more staunch lacunas between them. All right, so those are some of the social indicators that we learn from conventions, convention content, and how it spins out. Then we also have political indicators. Things like, what are the changes in party turfs? Where do the parties stand? How do they identify themselves? Who is the party of freedom? Who is the party of diversity? Who's the party of opportunity? Who's taking up which kind of mantle? And also, who's taking up what kinds of issues? What issues are discussed, which are ignored? And who's taking what stand on any particular issue? Those all become very clear when you start looking at the actual content of conventions. Just to give you a little kind of comparison between the 80s and the 2016-2012 era. First of all, I have to say, don't give Melania too hard of a time, because it's not like she's the only one borrowing liberally from others' ideas at times. So you've got Reagan Bush 1980 with the theme of let's make America great again, and then you've got Trump and Pence with make America great again. Must be that one word change that makes it okay. It's like let's versus we will do it, okay? Which actually gets reflected in the themes across those two time periods. When you talk about Reagan in the 80s, it was an era of optimism, which made him a big contrast against Carter, who was very pessimistic. If you don't recall the malaise speech that never used the word malaise, but very much was about, you know, a sacrifice and we're not doing so well, and it was pretty negative. Reagan was very optimistic. He made a lot of arguments about the greatness of the American people and American exceptionalism. The GOP was the party of patriotism that supported a strong military. It was all about the military, and that our common area, our enemy, was the Soviets. Right?
They made arguments about unity, let's all come together. They did that across party lines where many of Reagan's speeches included, or his acceptance address at the 80 and then again in the 84, was welcoming Democrats to come over. If you were a disaffected Democrat, come on over. And that started the craze of the Reagan Republican, right? People who were coming over and staying in their party, but supporting the other president.
And then what happens, they framed Carter not as this evil person, but as a well-meaning but incapable leader. He was ineffective. Right? You contrast that against what we've been seeing in 2012 and 2016, and you get a very different thematic party. You've got a lot of pessimism going on in the Republican Party. You've got a lot of divisiveness. This year, you've got this reliance on the individual leader in his acceptance address. Trump directly said, "I am the only person who can save us. Right? I'm the one who knows best." So he's, instead of saying, "Let's do it together," he says, I will do it once you elect me. Right? That's the reason you need to elect me. You got a sense of isolationism. You got an emphasis on difference and division that's been going on. You've got the common enemy being the Democrats rather than some external enemy. And you see this in 2012 when all of the speeches were very much about anybody but Obama. Right? Even the speeches that are usually very much about the candidate, like the spouse's speech, the vice president's speech, the nomination acceptance speech itself, usually talk about the candidate and why the candidate is good and the candidate needs to be picked up. Very, very few references to Mitt Romney and his qualifications directly. There were some, but not a whole lot. Instead, there were an overwhelming number of critiques of Obama instead. And so you get this pessimism despite this argument. You've got the idea of the anybody but Obama rather than saying pro-Mitt, right? And then, of course, this year, if you watched, there's the crooked Hillary, right? Not only was she crooked, she's a liar, she's a murderer. They have the repeated chance of lock her up, right? Which is kind of funny, they kept doing, like, lock her up with a big X. I'm like, no, lock her up. Right? This is, like, how many of you have been arrested? I guess maybe that's a different story for another day, right? So the idea is that there's a big distinction, so thematically, between what was going on in the 80s and what's going on now. Right? You look at the DNC, and some of the distinctions are clear, too. Didn't find the same kind of similarity of themes going on, but we did have, in 1980, Jimmy Carter was running, and he faced a challenger that was very popular that gave him a bit of a run for his money in Kennedy. Same sort of thing happened with Clinton and Bernie Sanders. And during the conventions, Kennedy came through, endorsed Carter, gave a great speech, by the way, and Bernie Sanders, same thing, came through, tried to get his supporters to get behind him. Didn't always work out quite so well for Bernie Sanders as much, but the attempt was made in the rhetoric. So in the 1980s, you had a squabbling party. There was some divisiveness going on. You have the soaring speeches that didn't really have a whole lot of electoral impact, but did talk a lot about the state of the culture of the country. You had the party of diversity. That was one of their big selling points. They're about diversity and opportunity, equality of opportunity. And then they framed Reagan as this Hollywood president that was out of touch, especially in 1984, when you had the Shining City on the Hill speech by Reagan a few weeks earlier, and the keynote address by Mario Cuomo actually said there are two cities. Right? It's a tale of two cities, the Shining City on the Hill and then all the rest of us that live kind of in the slums. Okay? So there was a division saying he was out of touch. You get to this year and the 2012-2016, again, some infighting going on, particularly this year, not so much in 2012. You get the party, again, still of diversity, still of opportunity, so those themes are staying consistent. But they started to co-opt some of the traditionally Republican themes, like supporting the military, and then they call for unity always, but the idea of embracing patriotism and saying who gets to be patriots. They got to define patriotism this year. They were trying to embrace the disaffected Republicans much more than any Republicans were trying to welcome in any Democrats, and they framed Trump as a dangerous buffoon, essentially, when you kind of comes down to it, that's probably the best way you could say it, because it was clownish, and it was also the danger factor. So you see some shifting that was going on here, too, but not nearly so much shifting, or not so much of a movement away from their core themes as they had been, as had happened with the Republicans. And the news also, the press picked this up very easily, because anybody who watched it probably should have been able to pick this up. And they were talking about flipping some of the scripts, especially the Democrats. Democrats grabbing on to Republican ideals, right? And things that had been Republican mainstays for a very long time. But it wasn't just the Republicans or the Democrats that were doing it. The Republicans were also, in very small ways, did it, particularly with Ivanka Trump's speech, where she was talking about things like childcare and leave for mothers and stuff like that, things that are not usually on the Republican platform, but she received these rousing applause for all of these things that were very much Democratic appeals most of the time. So what does this tell us in terms of the flip? Well, maybe the polarization that people keep talking about isn't as ideologically or topic driven as it is personality driven, which gives us a deeper motivation to dig deeper into the idea of what is really polarizing the nation. Because there seems to be some clear lines that are getting drawn, but where or why those lines are getting drawn is not nearly as clear if we're looking at the ways in which these themes have been shifting and changing. Okay. Personal and personality politics is very, very powerful, and that the messages and the messengers both matter very much when we're trying to take a look at these kinds of things. So these are just some of the lessons that we learned kind of broadly speaking. When we turn to the convention speeches themselves, we've got a whole lot of things that we can learn specifically from the different approaches. We're going to move a little more quickly here through it. We're just going to do a quick little thing. So keynotes, the point of keynote speeches are to establish the tone of the convention, highlight the topics that are going to be discussed, rally the base, and gain attention for the convention. This year, the DNC keynote speaker was Elizabeth Warren. She tells us a lot about who was trying to get appealed to, right? They were trying to get the Bernie supporters. They were going to try to get solidify support from the folks that were way on the progressive side of the liberal line. So they're pulling her in. She was the person a lot of people thought they wanted as the vice presidential nominee. So they were trying to get people who were disappointed that she wasn't the vice presidential nominee kind of on the side. So it tells a lot of those kinds of things. Some of the excerpts from her speech also talk about what kinds of issues were going on. People fighting for us. The tone of the speech was first anti-Trump, then pro-Hillary, in terms of the way that she was kind of setting it up. And then she also talked about things like spending, military, the 1% versus the 99%, a lot of the key topics that would then get played out over the course of the convention itself. It also places the convention within a historic context in that she was talking about the first woman to be nominated and to accept the nomination. So a very important keynote. The Republicans, I have nothing to tell you about because they did not designate a keynote speaker. This is the second time they've done this. They did that in 2000 as well. The 2000 RNC, they said, we're not going to designate one. People still had a tendency, they want to keynote so much that Laura Bush was called the keynote speaker, and Colin Powell was called the keynote speaker, but there really actually was no official keynote speaker, and that happened again this year with the Republican convention. Some people have argued because Trump didn't want to share that spotlight with anybody, so when he came on to announce Melania, he wanted that to be the moment of the night as opposed to having the spotlight off of him. Whether or not that's actually true, I've yet to verify, but I've found three different sources that have said that, so we're kind of hoping that might be an interesting story if it's not true. So, little rumor still. The spouses' speeches are something that I tend to spend a lot of time with, just because they're fun and interesting. But the spouses are usually used to humanize the husband, because it's usually a wife talking about a husband. Right? They're usually used to make the spouse seem more masculine and virile while also making him seem sensitive and approachable. Okay? So now we've got the first male giving this speech for a female. Interestingly enough, he does some of the similar things that he's supposed to. He humanizes her. He tells personal, intimate stories about her. Right? She was the girl that I fell in love with. I tapped her on the shoulder, you know. Kinds of this weird kind of, there's a little creepiness. He's like, I almost tapped her on the shoulder, but then I thought this would be different, so let's not do that. And I'm like, okay, that's weird. But the idea is that it was very personal stories, trying to show her as a warm human being. But if you really take a close look at what he says, he actually frames her in very feminine tones. So he feminizes her as opposed to masculinizes her.
masculinizes, which is what other people did. Melania had troubles of her own. Melania, first of all, there's the whole plagiarism thing. But second of all, she didn't actually do what speeches usually do when they're spouses. She didn't really provide personal insights into her husband. She didn't really humanize him. She had this weird line, his children have been cared for and mentored to the extent. She doesn't say he cared for his children. She didn't do like Laura Bush and talk about, you know, him rolling around on the ground playing hop on pop while reading Dr. Seuss. Right? There's none of that kind of personality that comes through. And so it kind of creates this weird tension. So she's only one of two spouses that doesn't kind of follow the mold. The other was Teresa Hines Carey, who didn't do it and then got totally trashed. She got totally panned for not fitting the nice wifey role and for not focusing on how loving her husband is. And so it's kind of interesting to see the response. Of course, most people's response to Melania was, she plagiarized, but, so. It took us off topic a little bit. But when you're looking at these speeches in particular, and this is my new project, you get to see a lot about gender expectations, sexual stereotyping that occurs, and it's surprisingly extremely traditional and restrictive for women, even still today. So it tells us something. There's, again, one of those social lessons. So when that book comes out, I'll come back, and that'll be kind of fun. Okay. And then you got presidential nomination addresses. And presidential nomination acceptance addresses are actually supposed to be the big pivot point, right? Pivot point to the general election. You're supposed to be able to establish the themes for the general election. The candidate's supposed to show their attitude, their perspective. You're supposed to build inoculation against criticism, build unity within a divided party, because you know that there's been this big primary battle and you want to bring people together. Donald Trump didn't do most of those. Other than showing, he established some more of his base. He was quite negative in his tone. Most of the time, these are more optimistic and more hopeful because they tend to be about providing a rhetorical vision people want to get behind and support. So this particular cartoon I thought was very telling because it takes the same words, and frames the attitudinal depiction that actually is pretty accurate for what happened in the two speeches. And you see Trump, if you read it downward, is extremely negative, talking about, it's getting worse, don't try to convince me the future is bright. When you take a closer look, there's anger and hate. But then with Clinton, which was actually a more optimistic speech, a more hopeful speech, you read it from the bottom up and you get the opposite words. So even just the part that I read before, you know, there's anger and hate because when you take a closer look, even if there's anger and hate because when you take a closer look, the future is bright in America, so it's a lot more optimistic. So it's kind of a nice, interesting, little fun twist on what's going on. It also gives you a sense of the not being able to control people's critiques of speeches, right? They go out there and then people will do what they're going to do with them. But as far as nomination acceptance addresses, Clinton actually did a more effective job of meeting the general requirements of a convention acceptance address and providing a more clear and positive rhetorical vision for people to follow. So her speech would be more appealing to a broader audience than Trump's speech, but Trump's speech would be more likely to solidify his base and to reify the messaging that he'd actually been presenting for quite some time.
Okay. So just one last little closing remarks. This is from a forthcoming book chapter that I'm coming out in Robert Denton's book on political campaign communication. And basically it just speaks to the fact that if you look at the different kinds of speeches, you get different things from it. But you need to actually look at these speeches because they are important. They provide insights. They provide information that sometimes is available elsewhere, but sometimes is not. And so it behooves us to not just dismiss conventions as being some ceremonial ritual of no consequence, because in fact, the fact that they are rituals, the fact that they are planned, the fact that so much effort and energy goes into them means that the messaging is extremely revealing and that we really need to take a little closer look, or maybe sometimes, as I do, a lot closer look. And then there's just some bibliographic information if you want to look up any additional stuff on this. Okay. So with that, I'll take any questions. Do you guys have questions?
Yeah, Michelle.
So at the beginning, you were sharing with us, that was very good, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
You were sharing with us
the critics of the conventions and saying that they're just coronations, they don't matter. Right. Can you categorize those people? Who are those people who typically have that point perspective?
Well, it's hard to just say particular individual kind of like particular categories, like, because I don't want there are people in those categories who would disagree with them. But a lot of political scientists who do a lot of quantitative research and need that element of I need the numbers to prove out something, right, as opposed to accepting the qualitative approaches and to really do deeper digging on smaller sample sets. Those folks tend to be the ones who say, you know, if you don't have the numbers that last or the numbers that endure, then you can't prove to me that it actually makes a difference. So that tends to be most of the divide is along those kinds of lines. Also, you get pundits who make that same sort of call, but I think most of that is just trying to get attention for what they're doing. So it's kind of like it's easier, and that's part of actually what the Shorenstein report said this morning was, you know, part of the idea is it's easier and more provoking to report negatively, right, than to actually report positively. Because people, you know, you open the newspaper and you see the headline, Brad and Angelina are divorcing. You know, if they said, Brad and Angelina are happily together still, not quite the media. So there's some instigatory sort of elements like that too, where it's much easier to be a critic or a negative critic because you can be a positive critic. Good question. Any others?
Yeah, that was fantastic. It was very interesting. And I was just curious because I know in the beginning you emphasized a lot of this coronation element of these conventions.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure if you've ever looked at the people who are picked who in some ways are representative of pop culture in terms of like the actors, the
yes.
singers like Katy Perry, even the athletes, right, who are picked. Mm-hmm. Do you think that in some ways redefines or characterizes these conventions in a much more entertainment context versus that informational knowledge-based context, which you were kind of trying to, I was just kind of curious about the pop culture element.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of that because a lot more pop culture folk started to show up, movie actors and stuff, in the 60s in different kinds of roles. In 1972, Jimmy Stewart introduced Pat Nixon to come up to the stage. He also narrated one of the bio tribute videos of her. And so that became sort of like big news. Jimmy Stewart's on the stage, and he's a Republican, and he's doing all of this stuff. And you get a lot of that sort of stuff that happened this time. Ooh, Antonio Sabato Jr. is going to talk at the RNC, right? Kind of. And what caliber of celebrity is going to show up? Some places, I think it's the LA Times, period, will do who's seen, who's been seen. People Magazine does it too. Who's been seen at the conventions? So the story isn't really about the convention, but who are the celebrities there? And I think that might contribute to it. But you also get the sort of endorsement people that have always been coming in. 1888, Frederick Douglass coming to speak to the RNC was a big deal. He was gaining getting the press to come report what was going on because Frederick Douglass was speaking. Right. So it became. So you've always had elements of that, but more so now, I think. So I think that's a fair assessment. And what does it do when you have like songs and you know you have the bands that are playing and it makes it more of a concert style thing? And I think it really does, but it also tells us about who's following along what kinds of lines. When you have John Voight narrating the Trump bio versus Morgan Freeman narrating the Clinton bio, you know, what does it say about, what does that say about who they are and what they're trying to evoke, what the party is trying to then evoke? Why do you invite Chachi to come speak? Some people say, well, we couldn't get anybody else, but they probably could have gotten somebody else, but somehow they thought that was appealing to a certain demographic. So that tells us something about what they're planning. Of course, then you get people like Tim Tebow who they said, oh, Tim Tebow, we've asked him to speak. And he said, no, I'm not coming. And very publicly said no. So you've got that part of the element too. So lots of stuff to consider, but it still tells us about who they think is appealing. Like the Democrats say, they're going to love Morgan Freeman. The Republicans say, oh yeah, Clint Eastwood, he's the guy. Yeah. Right. So the image that they're trying to portray is revealed in those kinds of stories too, or those kinds of performances or appearances.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the presentation. Really nice. Really good. Would you talk a little bit about, have you looked at the notion of ritual? You know, in other words, the rituals to some degree, it seems to me anyway, try to explain that which is beyond, it's almost a metaphysical explanation, right?
Okay.
So would you discuss just a little bit the use of ritual in these conventions and your reflections on the use of ritual?
Sure, there are a few things that happen all the time in the conventions. You always have the gathering in, you always have the gathering out, and those are just sort of the official marking of this is really a serious thing that we're doing, and this is the official events, and it kind of bookends that. So that's one of the rituals that I think is kind of an interesting one that has happened since the beginning. The rules debate is actually also ritualistic. Right now, most of the rules have actually been decided well before, but they do it as sort of a nod to the past. The roll call votes, you know, we know what the votes are going to be a month or two ahead of time, but they still do it because it demonstrates the history of the democratic process. Because the conventions, by the way, were started in by the Democrats in 1832 as a means of democratizing the actual process of selecting nominees. Before that, it had been done by committee. Committees would say, all right, this is going to be the next nominee, and they put them out there, and people would vote on them. The conventions, Andrew Jackson said, hey, let's make this more democratic. So they started doing those in 1832 for the Democrats, 1852 for the Republicans, in order to enhance the number of voices. Mm-hmm. And it did. You got more people being able to nominate a diverse pool of potential candidates for the nomination. They had more topics that came into discussion. So it was really about being more democratic. The problem happened when, in 1968, Hubert Humphrey won the nomination by only winning 3% of the primary vote. So when you do that, it very publicly was not democratic. So it became a question of, oh my goodness, you know, this is so undemocratic, we can't condone that anymore. So then that's when it shifts over to McGovern-Fraser Commission comes out, makes these recommendations. They tie they tie it to making the delegates bound to whatever that happened in their state, so that it would be more democratic. So then the ritual of doing the roll call vote re-emphasizes that idea of the movement towards democracy or enhanced democracy. So the conventions themselves are about enhancing democracy. Yeah. The roll call vote is even more so that. And then the fact that we're actually talking about our leaders and being able to critique and to assess them, that is also more of the democratic element. So yeah, it's very much about practicing democracy, even though it's no longer the harsh, deliberative, you know, jarring and sparring that people would like to have remembered it as.
Really good, thanks.
Sure. Yeah, so you talked about like the uncontrollable use of content and how people, especially on social media, remix a lot of the content that conventions. And it seemed that with the exception of the political cartoon that you showed at the end, all of that was negative criticism.
Sure.
Do you think that that's something that's intrinsic in user-generated content for the same reason as it is in journalism, that it's just easier, or that it gives people a greater sense of agency? Because it's not like users have to make circulation.
Yeah, that's true. I think that part of it is because it actually does become a little bit more widely circulated, because it's easier to be funny when you're being critical, right, negatively critical. And most people, things get more attention when they're funny, they're entertaining, that kind of thing, as opposed to, or jarring, as opposed to something that says, look how lovely it was to watch them play with balloons, right? People aren't gonna be like, oh, I'm gonna forward that to everyone on my, you know, Facebook feed. And so I think that is part of it, is just that sort of idea of generating views, generating likes, getting people to share your stuff. And also, it's a handy way for people who are feeling disaffected or not connected to the message that's being shared to express that, right? So if you're really going along with it, if you agree with it and it's speaking to you, you're probably going to let it be what it's going to be. When you are adversely responding to it because you disagree, then you're going to be thinking about the creative ways to use it as a critique against itself. And so I think that's really part of the strategic use. So, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I also just sort of to follow up, did you notice any sort of like major trends and means that were like positive or reinforcing, or was it mostly negative forces?
What I see, I haven't done a full study of them. It's just in terms of just what I've come across and what I look at, and most of them have been toward the negative. So, which has been sort of a recurring theme throughout the whole campaign. Anyway, people being critical of both sides, right? So either side or both sides, and so I think that's really. But I have not systematically studied that or examined that in any kind of way.
Okay. Tammy, thanks for doing this.
Sure.
I've covered eight conventions going back to 1980. And while they certainly are shows of party unity, I've always been struck by the disparity within the party, that it's not a monolithic thing.
Yeah.
A Massachusetts Republican is not a Texas Republican.
This is true.
Immigration resonates differently in this part of the country than it does in Texas and Arizona. It's always an interesting story to tease out those differences and try to figure out what the glue is that holds the party together. And second, I love the section on music. It's had such a long history. 1932, Franklin Roosevelt used Happy Days Are Here Again. The Clintons used Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow. My personal favorite spat was in 1996 when Bob Dole used 7 Days, I'm a Soul Man.
I remember that. I'm the Dole Man, yeah. Yeah, and it's always kind of interesting because even this year, there were a lot of late night show kind of critiques of Clinton's choice, right? We are the champions, and so they made a big joke, and it was done in multiple kinds of venues, of, you know, here's this staunch Republican who's supposed to be whatever, and they're using a song by a band with a homosexual leader, and you know, so it became kind of this weird, did you even pay attention to what you were choosing kind of thing? You just heard the words and ran with it kind of idea. And so it's really fun to look at the music too. I haven't actually done as much delving into that particularly, but yeah, there's so many components, just so many elements that are, and it's such a rich set of artifacts, and they recur all the time. One of the things I absolutely love about the fact that it's been, that the convention, well, there are two things. One, if you're a researcher, you get them every 4 years, so you have plenty of time to dissect them in between. But then number two is that you get the same repeated kinds of comparison points. So you can look at how the spouses have portrayed themselves or each other or women at large across time, or how keynotes went from being, you know, some, actually they started out more celebratory, became more issue focused, then moved back, and so there's this sort of shift back and forth. And so it's really interesting that you get the repeated elements that you can really study. And so I think the music would be a lot of fun to do over the long haul with that field of studies. Cool. Anything else? Anybody else? Questions?
Yeah. Why did you choose to compare the 1980 convention to the
when I did the book, I started with 1980 as sort of a contemporary point because 1976 was the last time there was a convention where there was a really solid contest where it could have actually gone the other way when Reagan was trying to unseat Ford. But from 1980 moving forward, that really, there hasn't been a real credible effort to unseat the primary winner. And so that's just sort of been the demarcation line for that. It's kind of like 1992 is always the demarcation line for speeches by spouses, even though there was one in 1940 by Eleanor Roosevelt. 1992, the year of the woman, was when Barbara Bush spoke in a real formal primetime speech. Before that, they'd only like show up and wave or stuff like that. Or they'd say, like some people say Pat Nixon gave a speech when it was actually 90 seconds long, and all she said was, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. Who says we don't attract young people? Thank you, thank you. And then she walked off stage. Like, that was almost verbatim what she did. And she's, you know, that's not a speech. So Barbara Bush speaking for like 20 minutes about, you know, all the wonderful qualities of her husband, that then becomes a speech. So there are the sort of demarcation lines. So I used 1980, and so that's where I went to right here, was just because that kind of makes sense for me in the timeline of the research that I've done.
Cool, thanks. As you're selecting the things that you analyze, how much, is there artifacts that exist sort of as primary sources, right, of all the things that happen in the convention, but how much consideration do you give to what's actually shown and presented to the more general public who don't have access to literally the daily, like, minute-by-minute things that happen at the convention?
Usually what I do is I tend to go with things that are prime time, that are done on most access channels. Like, you know, this year, it was whatever showed off PBS. Because people could actually access PBS both online and on their television sets, and so I'll do with the things that most people, that you don't need a special cable package to get or anything along those lines, and also the things that are recurrent. So the conventions, keynotes, the trickier part would be like being surrogates. If I were doing, again, like I did in the last book, surrogate speeches,
trying to justify why you pick one surrogate over another. In the last book, what I did was I picked surrogates that matched each other. So for example, there was a Christopher Reeve speech and Arnold Schwarzenegger speech. And while they are not exactly the same, because Arnold Schwarzenegger is the governor of California, there's still the celebrity elements to it, so I can actually compare those in terms of content. I would do things like say, okay, I want to do major former contenders. Right, and so in 2008, I would pick Hillary Clinton because she was a major contender, a former contender against Obama, and then I would probably pick, you know, like, it was 2008, it was McCain, so I might do Mitt Romney, right, and then do those kinds of speeches. And I would kind of try to pick pivot points like that that made sense rationally, but also things that people can access. For my research, I don't do quite as much of the sort of audience impact measures. Like what I say is, these are the messages that are out there, and these are the themes, and these are the kinds of things that they tell us, as opposed to saying, this is what the audience walked away knowing. So it's a little bit less vital for me to be able to say, 87 million people saw this speech, or 20, you know, for this year, I think it was 30 million people watched the acceptance addresses. So that kind of thing is a lot, that's a little bit less important for what I'm doing, as opposed to somebody else who would be doing sort of the effects element. Mine's just more like, this would tell us the revelatory element. Anything else? I think we're out of time. We're well over.
Thank you, Tammy.
Thank you all. Great audience.